Mormont sent a raven from the haunted forest. Pylos underlined the words with the point of his finger. The haunted forest. He is under attack. Yes. Pleased, he ploughed onward. Other birds have come since with no words. We fear Mormont slain with all his tench. No strength. We fear Mormont slain with all his strength. Davos suddenly realized just what he was reading. He turned the letter over and saw that the wax that had sealed it had been black. This is from the Night's Watch. Maester, has King Stannis seen this letter?
I brought it to Lord Alistair when it first arrived. He was the hand then. I believed he discussed it with the Queen. When I asked him if he wished to send a reply, he told me not to be a fool. His Grace lacks the men to fight his own battles. He has none to waste on wildlings, he said to me.
Well, that was true enough, and this talk of five kings would certainly have angered Stannis.
Only a starving man begs bread from a beggar, he muttered.
Pardon, my lord?
Something my wife once said.
Davos drummed his shortened fingers against the tabletop. The first time he had seen the wall, he had been younger than Devon, serving aboard the Cubblecat under Roro Euhorus, a Tyrushi, known up and down the narrow sea as the Blind Bastard, though he was neither blind nor base-born. Roro had sailed past Skagus into the Shivering Sea, visiting 100 little coves that had never seen a trading ship before. He brought steel, swords, axes, helms, good chainmail hauberks to trade for furs, ivory, amber, and obsidian. When the Cubblecat turned back south, her holds were stuffed, but in the Bay of Seals, three black galleys came out to herd her into Eastwatch. They lost their cargo, and the bastard lost his head, for the crime of trading weapons to the wildlings. Davos had traded at Eastwatch in his smuggling days. The Black Brothers made hard enemies but good customers, for a ship with the right cargo. But while he may have taken their coin, he never forgot how the blind bastard's head had rolled across the Cobblecat's deck.
"I met some wildlings when I was a boy," he told Maester Pylos. "They were fair thieves, but bad hagglers. One made off with our cabin girl. All in all, they seem men like any other men, some fair, some foul."
"Men are men," Maester Pylos agreed. "Shall we return to our reading, my lord hand?"
"I am the hand of the king, yes."
Stannis might be the king of Westeros in name, but in truth he was king of the Painted Table. He held Dragonstone and Storm's End, and had an ever more uneasy alliance with Salador Saan, but that was all. How could the Watch have looked to him for help?
"They may not know how weak he is, how lost his cause. King Stannis never saw this letter. You're quite certain? Nor Melisande?"
"No. Or should I bring it to them, even now?"
"No," Davos said at once. "You did your duty when you brought it to Lord Alistair. If Melisande knew of this letter, what was it she had said? One whose name may not be spoken is marshalling his powers, Davos Seaworth. Soon comes a cold and a night that never ends."
And Stannis had seen a vision in the flames, a ring of torches in the snow with terror all around.
"My lord, are you unwell?" asked Pylos.
"I am frightened, maester,"
he might have said. Davos was remembering a tale Salador Saan had told him, of how Azor Ahai tempered Lightbringer by thrusting it through the heart of the wife he loved.
"He slew his wife to fight the dark. If Stannis's Azor Ahai come again, does that mean Edric Storm must play the part of Nisir Nisir?"
"I was thinking, maester, my pardons.
What harm if some wildling king conquers the North?
It was not as though Stannis held the North. His grace could scarcely be expected to defend people who refused to acknowledge him as king.
"Give me another letter," he said abruptly. "This one is too...
difficult," suggested Pylos.
"Soon comes the cold," whispered Melisande, "and the night that never ends."
"Troubling," said Davos. "Too troubling. A different letter, please."
John. They woke to the smoke of Molestown burning. Atop the king's tower, Jon Snow leaned on the padded crutch that Maester Aemon had given him and watched the grey plume rise. Styr had lost all hope of taking Castle Black unawares when Jon escaped him, yet even so he need not have warned of his approach so bluntly.
"You may kill us," he reflected, "but no one will be butchered in their beds. That much I did, at least."
His legs still hurt like blazes when he put his weight on it. He'd needed Clydus to help him don his fresh-washed blacks and lace up his boots that morning, and by the time they were done, he'd wanted to drown himself in the milk of the poppy. Instead, he had settled for half a cup of dream wine, a chew of willow bark, and the crutch. The beacon was burning on Weatherback Ridge, and the night's watch had need of every man. "I can fight," he insisted when they tried to stop him.
"Sir, your leg's healed, is it?"
Noy snorted.
"You won't mind me giving it a little kick, then?"
"I'd sooner you didn't. It's stiff, but I can hobble around well enough, and stand and fight, if you have need of me."
"I have need of every man who knows which end of a spear to stab into the wildlings."
"The pointy end?" John had told his little sister something like that once, he remembered. Noy rubbed the bristle on his chin.
"Might be you'll do. We'll put you on a tower with a longbow. But if you bloody well fall off, don't come crying to me."
He could see the King's Road wending its way south through stony brown fields and over windswept hills. The Magnar would be coming up that road before the day was done, his thens marching behind him with axes and spears in their hands and their bronze and leather shields on their backs. Grig the Goat, Court, Big Boyle, and the rest will be coming as well. And Ygritte. The wildlings had never been his friends. He had not allowed them to be his friends. But her. He could feel the throb of pain where her arrow had gone through the meat and muscle of his thigh. He remembered the old man's eyes, too, and the black blood rushing from his throat as the storm cracked overhead. But he remembered the grotto best of all. The look of her naked in the torchlight. The taste of her mouth when it opened under his.
"Ygritte, stay away. Go south and raid. Go hide in one of those round towers you like so well. You'll find nothing here but death."
Across the yard, one of the bowmen on the roof of the old flint barracks had unlaced his breeches and was pissing through a crenel. Mully, he knew from the man's greasy orange hair. Men in black cloaks were visible on other roofs and tower tops as well, though 9 of every 10 happened to be made of straw.
"The Scarecrow Sentinels," Donald Noy called them.
"Only we're the crows," John mused, "and most of us were scared enough." Whatever you call them, the straw soldiers had been Maester Aemon's notion. They had more breeches and jerkins and tunics in the storerooms than they had had men to fill them. So why not stuff some with straw, drape a cloak around their shoulders, and set them to standing watches? Noy had placed them on every tower and in half the windows. Some were even clutching spears, who had crossbows cocked under their arms. The hope was that the Fens would see them from afar and decide that Castle Black was too well defended to attack. John had 6 scarecrows, sharing the roof of the King's Tower with him, along with 2 actual breathing brothers. Deaf Dick Fallard sat in a crenel, methodically cleaning and oiling the mechanism of his crossbow to make sure the wheel turned smoothly, while the Old Town boy wandered restlessly around the parapets, fussing with the clothes on straw men.
Maybe he thinks they will fight better if they're posed just right. Or maybe this waiting is fraying his nerves the way it's fraying mine. The boy claimed to be 18, older than John, but he was green as summer grass for all that. Satin, they called him, even in the wool and mail and boiled leather of the night's watch. The name he'd gotten in the brothel where he'd been born and raised. He was pretty as a girl, with his dark eyes, soft skin, and raven's ringlets. Half a year at Castle Black had toughened up his hands, however, and Noy said he was passable with a crossbow. Whether he had the courage to face what was coming, though? John used a crutch to limp across the tower top. The King's Tower was not the castle's tallest. The high, slim, crumbling lance held that honour, though Othel Yarwick had been heard to say it might topple any day. Nor was the King's Tower strongest. The Tower of Guards beside the King's Road would be a tougher nut to crack. But it was tall enough, strong enough, and well placed beside the wall, overlooking the gate and the foot of the wooden stair. The first time he had seen Castle Black with his own eyes, John had wondered why anyone would be so foolish as to build a castle without walls. How could it be defended?
"It can't," his uncle told him. "That is the point. The Night's Watch is pledged to take no part in the quarrels of the realm. Yet over the centuries, certain lords commander, more proud than wise, forgot their vows and ne'er destroyed us all with their ambitions. Lord Commander Runcel Hightower tried to bequeath the watch to his bastard son. Lord Commander Rudrick Flint thought to make himself king beyond the wall. Tristan Mudd, Mad Mark Rankenfell, Robin Hill. Did you know that 600 years ago, the commanders at Snowgate and the Nightfort went to war against each other, and when the Lord Commander tried to stop them, they joined forces to murder him. The Stark in Winterfell had to take a hand, and both their heads, which he did easily because their strongholds were not defensible. The Night's Watch had 996 Lords Commander before Jor Mormont, most of them men of courage and honour. But we have had cowards and fools as well, our tyrants and our madmen. We survive because the lords and kings of the Seven Kingdoms know that we pose no threat to them, no matter who should lead us. Our only foes are to the north, and to the north we have the wall.
Only now those foes had gotten past the wall to come up from the south, John reflected, and the lords and kings of the Seven Kingdoms have forgotten us. We are caught between the hammer and the anvil. Without a wall, Castle Black could not be held. Donald Noy knew that as well as any.
"The castle does them no good," the armourer told his little garrison. "Kitchens, common hall, stables, even the towers. Let them take it all. We'll empty the armory and move what stores we can to the top of the wall and make our stand around the gate."
So Castle Black had a wall of sorts at last, a crescent-shaped barricade 10 feet high, made of stores, casks of nails and barrels of salt mutton, crates, bales of black broadcloth, stacked logs, sawn timbers, fire-hardened stakes, and sacks of grain. The crude rampart enclosed the two things most worth defending, the gate to the north and the foot of the great wooden switchback stair that clawed and climbed its way up the face of the wall like a drunken thunderbolt, supported by wooden beams as big as tree trunks driven deep into the ice. The last few moles were still making the long climb, John saw, urged on by his brothers. Gran was carrying a little boy in his arms, while Pip, two flights below, let an old man lean upon his shoulder. The oldest villagers still waited below for the cage to make its way back down to them. He saw a mother pulling along two children, one on either hand, as an older boy ran past her up the steps. 200 feet above them, Sky Blue Sue and Lady Meliana, who was no lady, all her friends agreed, stood on the landing looking south. They had a better view of the smoke than he did, no doubt. John wondered about the villagers who had chosen not to flee. There were always a few, too stubborn
or too stupid, or too brave to run. A few who preferred to fight, or hide, or bend the knee. Maybe the Thins would spare them. The thing to do would be to take the attack to them, he thought. With 50 rangers well mounted, we could cut them apart on the road. They did not have 50 rangers, though, nor half as many horses. The garrison had not returned, and there was no way to know just where they were, or even whether the riders that Noy had sent out had reached them. We are the garrison, John told himself, and look at us. The brothers Bowenmarsh had left behind were old men, cripples, and green boys, just as Donal Noy had warned him. He could see some wrestling barrels up the steps, others on the barricade. Stout old kegs, as slow as ever. Spare boot, hopping along briskly on his carved wooden leg. Half-mad Easy, who fancied himself Florian the Fool reborn. Dornish Dilly. Red Allen of the Rosewood. Young Henley, well past 50. Old Henley, well past 70. Hairy Hal, Spotted Pate of Maidenpool. A couple of them saw John looking down from atop the King's Tower and waved up at him. Others turned away. They still think me a turncloak. That was a bitter draught to drink, but John could not blame them. He was a bastard, after all. Everyone knew that bastards were wanton and treacherous by nature, having been born of lust and deceit. And he had made as many enemies as friends at Castle Black. Rast, for one. John had once threatened to have Ghost rip his throat out unless he stopped tormenting Samuel Tarley, and Rast did not forget things like that. He was raking dry leaves into piles under the stairs just now, but every so often he stopped long enough to give John a nasty look. No! Donal Noy roared at three of the Molestown men down below. The pitch goes to the hoist, the oil up the steps. Crossbow bolts to the 4th, 5th, and 6th landings. Spears to the 1st and 2nd. Stack the lard under the stair. Yes, there. Behind the planks. The casks of meat are for the barricade. Now, you puxy plough pushers, now!
He has a lord's voice, John thought. His father had always said that in battle a captain's lungs were as important as his sword arm. It does not matter how brave or brilliant a man is if his commands cannot be heard, Lord Eddard told his sons. So Rob and he used to climb the towers of Winterfell to shout at each other across the yard. Donal Noy could have drowned out both of them. The moles all went in terror of him, and rightfully so, since he was always threatening to rip their heads off. 3/4 of the village had taken John's warning to heart and come to Castle Black for refuge. Noy had decreed that every man still spry enough to hold a spear or swing an axe would help defend the barricade, else they could damn well go home and take their chances with the Thens. He had emptied the armory to put good steel in their hands, big double-bladed axes, razor-sharp daggers, long swords, maces, spiked morning stars. Clad in studded leather jerkins and mail hauberks, with greaves for their legs, and gorgets to keep their heads on their shoulders, a few of them even looked like soldiers. In a bad light, if you squint. Noy had put the women and children to work as well. Those too young to fight would carry water and tend the fires. The Molestown midwife would assist Clydus, and Maester Aemon would any wounded. And Three Finger Hub suddenly had more spit-boys, kettle-stirrers, and onion-choppers than he knew what to do with. Two of the whores had even offered to fight, and had shown enough skill with a crossbow to be given a place on the steps 40 feet up. "It's cold." Satin stood with his hands tucked into his armpits under his cloak. His cheeks were bright red. John made himself smile. "The Frostfangs are cold. This is a brisk autumn day." "Well, I hope I never see the Frostfangs, then. I knew a girl in Oldtown who liked to ice her wine. That's the best place for ice, I think, in wine." Satin glanced south, frowned. "You think the Scarecrow sentinels scared them off, my lord?"
"We can hope."
It was possible, John supposed, but more likely the wildlings had simply paused for a bit of rape and plunder in Molestown. Or maybe Stir was waiting for nightfall to move up under cover of darkness. Midday came and went, with still no sign of Thens on the King's Road. John heard footsteps inside the tower, though, and Owen the Oaf popped up out of the trapdoor, red-faced from the climb. He had a basket of buns under one arm, a wheel of cheese under the other, a bag of onions dangling from one hand.
"Hobbs had to feed you in case you're stuck up here a while."
"That, or for our last meal." "Thank him for us, Owen." Dick Follard was deaf as a stone, but his nose worked well enough. The buns were still warm from the oven when he went digging in the basket and plucked one out. He found a crock of butter as well, and spread some with his dagger.
"Raisins," he announced happily. "Nuts, too."
His speech was thick, but easy enough to understand once you got used to it.
"You can have mine, too," said Sutton. "I'm not hungry."
"Eat," John told him. "There's no knowing when you'll have another chance." He took two buns himself. The nuts were pine nuts, and besides the raisins there were bits of dried apple.
"Well, the wildlings come today, Lord Snow?" Owen asked.
"You'll know if they do," said John. "Listen for the horns."
"Two. Two is for wildlings."
Owen was tall, tow-headed, and amiable. A tireless worker and surprisingly deft when it came to working wood and fixing catapults and the like. But as he'd gladly tell you, his mother had dropped him on his head when he was a baby, and half his wits had leaked out through his ear. "You remember where to go?" John asked him.
"I'm to go to the stairs," Donald Noy says. "I'm to go up to the third landing and shoot my crossbow down at the wildlings if they try to climb over the barrier. The third landing, 1, 2, 3.
His head bobbed up and down.
"If the wildlings attack, the king will come and help us, won't he? He's a mighty warrior, King Robert. He's sure to come. Maester Aemon sent him a bird."
There was no use telling him that Robert Baratheon was dead. He would forget it, as he'd forgotten it before. "Maester Aemon sent him a bird," John agreed. That seemed to make Owen happy. Maester Aemon had sent a lot of birds, not to one king, but to 4. "Wildlings at the gate," the message ran. "The realm in danger. Send all the help you can to Castle Black." Even as far as Old Town and the citadel the ravens flew, and to 50 mighty lords in their castles, the northern lords offered their best hope. So to them Aemon had sent 2 birds, to the Umbers and the Boltons, to Castle Serwyn and Torren Square, Carhold and Deepwood Mott, to Bear Island, Old Castle, Widow's Watch, White Harbour, Barrowton and the Rills, to the mountain fastnesses of the Liddles, the Burleys, the Norreys, the Harclays and the Walls, the blackbirds brought their plea. "Wildlings at the gate. The north in danger. Come with all your strength." Well, ravens might have wings, but lords and kings do not. If help was coming, it would not come today. As morning turned to afternoon, the smoke of Molestown blew away, and the southern sky was clear again. No clouds, thought John. That was good. Rain or snow could doom them all. Clydus and Maester Aemon rode the winch cage up to safety at the top of the wall, and most of the Molestown wives as well. Men in black cloaks paced restlessly on the tower tops and shouted back and forth across the courtyards. Septon Celador led the men on the barricade in a prayer, beseeching the warrior to give them strength. Deaf Dick Follard curled up beneath his cloak and went to sleep. Satin walked 100 leagues in circles, round and round the crenellations. The wall wept, and the sun crept across a hard blue sky. Near evenfall, Owen the Oaf returned with a loaf of black bread and a pail of Hobbs' best mutton, cooked in a thick broth of ale and onions. Even Dick woke up for that. They ate every bit of it, using chunks of bread to wipe the bottom of the pail. By the time they were done, the sun was low in the west, the shadows sharp and black throughout the castle. "Light the fire," John told Saturn, "and fill the kettle with oil." He went downstairs himself to bar the door, to try and work some of the stiffness from his leg. That was a mistake, and John soon knew it. But he clutched the crutch and saw it through all the same. The door to the King's Tower was oak, studded with iron. It might delay the Thens, but it would not stop them if they wanted to come in. John slammed the bar down in its notches, paid a visit to the privy, it might well be his last chance, and hobbled back up to the roof, grimacing at the pain. The west had gone the colour of a blood bruise, but the sky above was cobalt blue, deepening to purple, and the stars were coming out. John sat between two merlons, with only a scarecrow for company, and watched the stallion gallop up the sky. Or was it the Horned Lord? He wondered where Ghost was now. He wondered about Ygritte as well, and told himself that way lay madness. They came in the night, of course. Like thieves, John thought, like murderers. Saturn pissed himself when the horns blew, but John pretended not to notice. "Go shake Dick by the shoulder," he told the old town boy, "else he's liable to sleep through the fight." "I'm frightened." Saturn's face was a ghastly white. "So are they." John leaned his crutch up against a merlin and took up his longbow, bending the smooth, thick Dornish yew to slip a bowstring through the notches. "Don't waste a quarrel, unless you know you have a good clean shot," he said when Saturn returned from waking Dick. "We have an ample supply up here, but ample does not mean inexhaustible. And step behind a merlin to reload. Don't try and hide in back of a scarecrow. They're made of straw. An arrow will punch through them." He did not bother telling Dick Follard anything. Dick could read your lips if there was enough light, and he gave a damn what you were saying. But he knew it all already. The three of them took up positions on three sides of the round tower. John hung a quiver from his belt and pulled an arrow. The shaft was black, the fletching grey. As he notched it to his string, he remembered something that Theon Greyjoy had once said after a hunt. "The boar can keep his tusks, and the bear his claws," he had declared, smiling the way he did. "There's nothing half so mortal as a grey goose feather." John had never been half the hunter that Theon was, but he was no stranger to the longbow either. There were dark shapes slipping around the armory, backs against the stone, but he could not see them well enough to waste an arrow. He heard distant shouts, and saw the archers on the Tower of Guards loosing shafts at the ground. That was too far off to concern John. But when he glimpsed three shadows detach themselves from the old stables 50 yards away, he stepped up to the crenel, raised his bow, and drew. They were running, so he led them, waiting, waiting. The arrow made a soft hiss as it left his string. A moment later there was a grunt, and suddenly only two shadows were loping across the yard. They ran all the faster, but John had already pulled a second arrow from his quiver. This time he hurried the shot too much and missed. The wildlings were gone by the time he'd knocked again. He searched for another target and found four, rushing around the empty shell of the Lord Commander's keep. The moonlight glimmered off their spears and axes and the gruesome devices on their round leather shields, skulls and bones, serpents, bear's claws, twisted demonic faces. Free folk, he knew. The Thens carried shields of black boiled leather with bronze rims and bosses, but theirs were plain and unadorned. These were the lighter, wicker shields of raiders. John pulled the goose feather back to his ear, aimed, and loosed the arrow, then knocked and drew and loosed again. The first shaft pierced the bear claw shield, the second one a throat. The wildling screamed as he went down. He heard the deep thrum of Deaf Dick's crossbow
to his left, and satins a moment later.
"I got one," the boy cried hoarsely. "I got one in the chest."
"Get another," John called. He did not have to search for targets now, only choose them. He dropped a wildling archer as he was fitting an arrow to his string, then sent a shaft toward the axeman, hacking at the door of Harden's tower. That time he missed, but the arrow, quivering in the oak, made the wildling reconsider. It was only as he was running off that John recognized Big Boyle. Half a heartbeat later, old Mully put an arrow through his leg from the roof of the Flint barracks, and he crawled off bleeding. That will stop him bitching about his Boyle, John thought. When his quiver was empty, he went to get another and moved to a different crenel, side by side with Deaf Dick Follard. John got off 3 arrows for every bolt Deaf Dick discharged, but that was the advantage of the longbow. The crossbow penetrated better, some insisted, but it was slow and cumbersome to reload. He could hear the wildlings shouting to each other, and somewhere to the west a war horn blew. The world was moonlight and shadow, and time became an endless round of notch and draw and loose. A wildling arrow ripped through the throat of the straw sentinel beside him, but John Snow scarcely noticed. "Give me one clean shot at the Magnar of Thenn," he prayed to his father's gods. The Magnar, at least, was a foe that he could hate. "Give me stir." His fingers were growing stiff, and his thumb was bleeding, but still John notched and drew and loosed. A gout of flame caught his eye, and he turned to see the door of the common hall afire. It was only a few moments before the whole great timber hall was burning. 3-finger Hub and his Molestown helpers were safe atop the wall, he knew. But it felt like a punch in the belly all the same.
"John!"
Deaf Dick yelled in his thick voice.
"The armory!"
They were on the roof, he saw. One had a torch. Dick hopped onto the crenel for a better shot, jerked his crossbow to his shoulder, and sent a quarrel thrumming towards the torchman. He missed. The archer down below him didn't. Follard never made a sound, only toppled forward, headlong, over the parapet. It was 100 feet to the yard below. John heard the thump as he was peering around a straw soldier trying to see where the arrow had come from. Not 10 feet from Deaf Dick's body, he glimpsed a leather shield, a ragged cloak, a mop of thick red hair. "Kissed by fire," he thought. "Lucky." He brought his bow up, but his fingers would not part, and she was gone as suddenly as she'd appeared. He swiveled, cursing, and loosed a shaft at the men on the armory roof instead, but he missed them as well. By then the east stables were afire too, black smoke and wisps of burning hay pouring from the stalls. When the roof collapsed, flames rose up roaring so loud they almost drowned out the war horns of the Thenns. 50 of them were pounding up the King's Road in tight column, their shields held up above their heads. Others were swarming through the vegetable garden, across the flagstone yard, around the old dry well. 3 had hacked their way through the doors of Maester Aemon's apartments in the timber keep below the rookery, and a desperate fight was going on atop the silent tower, longswords against bronze axes. None of that mattered. "The dance has moved on," he thought. John hobbled across to Satin and grabbed him by the shoulder. "With me!" he shouted. Together they moved to the north parapet, where the King's Tower looked down on the gate, and Donald Noy's makeshift wall of lugs and barrels and sacks of corn. The Thenns were there before them. They wore half-helms and had thin bronze discs sewn to their long leather shirts. Many wielded bronze axes, though a few were chipped stone. More had short stabbing spears with leaf-shaped heads that gleamed redly in the light from the burning stables. They were screaming in the old tongue as they stormed the barricade, jabbing with their spears, swinging their bronze axes, spitting corn and blood with equal abandon, while crossbow quarrels and arrows rained down on them from the archers that Donald Noy had posted on the stair. "What do we do?" Satin shouted. "We kill them," John shouted back, a black arrow in his hand. No archer could have asked for an easier shot.
The Fens had their backs to the King's Tower as they charged the crescent, clambering over bags and barrels to reach the men in black. Both John and Satin chanced to choose the same target. He had just reached the top of the barricade when an arrow sprouted from his neck, and a quarrel between his shoulder blades. Half a heartbeat later, a longsword took him in the belly, and he fell back onto the man behind him. John reached down to his quiver and found it empty again. Satin was winding back his crossbow. He left him to it, and went for more arrows, but he hadn't taken more than 3 steps before the trap slammed open 3 feet in front of him. Bloody hell! I never even heard the door break. There was no time to think or plan or shout for help. John dropped his bow, reached back over his shoulder, ripped Longclaw from its sheath, and buried the blade in the middle of the first head to pop out of the tower. Bronze was no match for Valyrian steel. The blow sheared right through the Then's helm and deep into his skull, and he went crashing back down where he'd come from. There were more behind him. John knew from the shouting. He fell back and called a Satin. The next man to make the climb got a quarrel through his cheek. He vanished too. "The oil!" John said. Satin nodded. Together they snatched up the thick quilted pads they'd left beside the fire, lifted the heavy kettle of boiling oil, and dumped it down the hole on the Fens below. The shrieks were as bad as anything he'd ever heard, and Satin looked as if he was going to be sick. John kicked the trapdoor shut, set the heavy iron kettle on top of it, and gave the boy with a pretty face a hard shake. "Wretch, later!" John yelled. "Come!" They had only been gone from the parapets for a few moments, but everything below had changed. A dozen black brothers and a few Molestown men still stood atop the crates and barrels, but the wildlings were swarming over all along the crescent, pushing them back. John saw one shove his spear up through Rast's belly so hard it lifted him into the air. Young Henley was dead, and old Henley was dying, surrounded by foes. He could see Easy spinning and slashing, laughing like a loon, his cloak flapping as he leapt from cask to cask. A bronze axe caught him just below the knee, and the laughter turned into a bubbling shriek. "They're breaking," Satin said. "No," said John, "they're broken." It happened quickly. One mole fled, then another, and suddenly all the villagers were throwing down their weapons and abandoning the barricade. The brothers were too few to hold alone. John watched them try and form a line to fall back in order, but the Fens washed over them with spear and axe, and then they were fleeing too. Dornish Dilly slipped and went down in his face, and a wildling planted a spear between his shoulder blades. Keggs, slow and short of breath, had almost reached the bottom step when a Then caught the end of his cloak and yanked him around. But a crossbow quarrel dropped the man before his axe could fall. "Gut him!" Satin crowed, as Keggs staggered to the stair and began to crawl up the steps on hands and knees. The gate is lost. Donald Noy had closed and chained it, but it was there for the taking, the iron bars glimmering red with reflected firelight, the coal-black tunnel behind. No one had fallen back to defend it. The only safety was on top of the wall, 700 feet up the crooked wooden stairs. "What guards do you pray to?" John asked Satin. "The Seven," the boy from Old Town said. "Pray then," John told him. "Pray to your new gods, and I'll pray to my old ones." It all turned here. With a confusion at the trapdoor, John had forgotten to fill his quiver. He limped back across the roof, and did that now, and picked up his bow as well. The kettle had not moved from where he'd left it, so it seemed as though they were safe enough for the nonce. The dance has moved on, and we're watching from the gallery, he thought as he hobbled back. Satin was loosing quarrels at the wildlings on the steps, then ducking down behind a Merlin to cock the crossbow. He may be pretty, but he's quick. The real battle was on the steps. Noy had put spearmen on the 2 lowest landings, but the headlong flight of the villagers had panicked them, and they had joined the flight, racing up toward the 3rd landing with the Fens killing anyone who fell behind.
The archers and crossbowmen on the higher landings were trying to drop shafts over their heads. John knocked an arrow, drew and loosed, and was pleased when one of the wildlings went rolling down the steps. The heat of the fires was making the wall weep, and the flames danced and shimmered against the ice. The steps shook to the footsteps of men running for their lives. Again John notched and drew and loosed, but there was only one of him and one of Saturn, and a good 60 or 70 Thens pounding up the stairs, killing as they went, drunk on victory. On the fourth landing, three brothers in black cloaks stood shoulder to shoulder with long swords in their hands, and battle was joined again briefly. But there were only three, and soon enough the wilding tide washed over them, and their blood dripped down the steps. A man is never so vulnerable in battle as when he flees, Lord Eddard had told John once. A running man is like a wounded animal to a soldier. It gets his bloodlust up. The archers on the fifth landing fled before the battle even reached them. It was a rout, a red rout. "Fetch the torches," John told Saturn. There were four of them stacked beside the fire, their heads wrapped in oily rags. There were a dozen fire arrows, too. The old town boy thrust one torch into the fire until it was blazing brightly, and brought the rest back under his arm unlit. He looked frightened again, as well he might. John was frightened, too. It was then that he saw a stir. The Magna was climbing up the barricade over the gutted corn sacks and smashed barrels and the bodies of friends and foe alike. His bronze-scale armor gleamed darkly in the firelight. Stir had taken off his helm to survey the scene of his triumph, and the bald, earless Horsen was smiling. In his hand was a long weirwood spear with an ornate bronze head. When he saw the gate, he pointed the spear at it and barked something in the old tongue to the half-dozen Thens around him. "Too late," John thought. "You should have led your men over the barricade. You might have been able to save a few." Up above, a war horn sounded, long and low. Not from the top of the wall, but from the ninth landing, some 200 feet up, where Donal Noy was standing. John notched a fire arrow to his bowstring and sat in lit it from the torch. He stepped to the parapet, drew, aimed, loosed. Ribbons of flame trailed behind as the shaft sped downward and thudded into its target, crackling. Not stir. The steps, or more precisely, the casks and kegs and sacks that Donal Noy had piled up beneath the steps, as high as the first landing. The barrels of lard and lamp oil, the bags of leaves and oily rags, the split logs, bark, and wood shavings. "Again," said John. "And again, and again." Other longbowmen were firing, too, from every tower top in range, some sending their arrows up in high arcs to drop before the wall. When John ran out of fire arrows, he and Saturn began to light the torches and fling them from the crenels. Up above, another fire was blooming. The old wooden steps had drunk up oil like a sponge, and Donal Noy had drenched them from the ninth landing all the way down to the seventh. John could only hope that most of their own people had staggered up to safety before Noy threw the torches. The Black Brothers at least had known the plan, but the villagers had not. Wind and fire did the rest. All John had to do was watch. With flames below and flames above, the wildlings had nowhere to go. Some continued upward and died. Some went downward and died. Some stayed where they were. They died as well. Many leapt from the steps before they burned and died from the fall. 20-odd Thens were still huddled together between the fires when the ice cracked from the heat, and the whole lower third of the stair broke off, along with several tons of ice. That was the last that John Snow saw of Stir, the Magnar of Then. "The wall defends itself," he thought. John asked Saturn to help him down to the yard. His wounded leg hurt so badly that he could hardly walk even with a crutch. "Bring the torch," he told the boy from Oldtown. I need to look for someone. It had been mostly Thens on the steps. Surely some of the free folk had escaped. Mansa's people, not the Magnars. She might have been one. So they climbed down, past the bodies of the men who'd tried the trapdoor, and John wandered through the dark, with his crutch under one arm and the other around the shoulders of a boy who'd been a whore in Old Town. The stables and the common hall had burned down to smoking cinders by then, but the fire still raged along the wall, climbing step by step and landing by landing. From time to time they'd hear a groan, and then a crack, and another chunk would come crashing off the wall. The air was full of ash and ice crystals. He found Court dead, and Stone Thumbs dying. He found some dead and dying Thens he'd never truly known. He found Big Boyle, weak from all the blood he'd lost, but still alive. He found Ygritte, sprawled across a patch of old snow beneath the Lord Commander's tower, with an arrow between her breasts. The ice crystals had settled over her face, and in the moonlight it looked as though she wore a glittering silver mask. The arrow was black, John saw, but it was fletched with white duck feathers. "Not mine," he told himself. "Not one of mine." But he felt as if it were. When he knelt in the snow beside her, her eyes opened.
"John Snow," she said, very softly. It sounded as though the arrow had found a lung. "Is this a proper castle now, not just a tower?"
"It is." John took her hand.
"Good," she whispered. "I wanted to see one proper castle before I—"
"You'll see 100 castles," he promised her. "The battle's done. Maester Aemon will see to you." He touched her hair.
"You're kissed by fire, remember? Lucky. It will take more than an arrow to kill you.
Aemon will draw it out and patch you up, and will get you some milk of the puppy for the pain." She just smiled at that.
"Do you remember that cave? We should have stayed in that cave. I told you so."
"We'll go back to the cave," he said. "You're not going to die, Ygritte. You're not."
"Oh."
Ygritte cupped his cheek with her hand.
"You know nothing, Jon Snow."
She sighed, dying.
Bran.
"It's only another empty castle,"
Mira Reed said, as she gazed across the desolation of rubble, ruins, and weeds. "No," thought Bran, "it is the Night Fort, and this is the end of the world." In the mountains, all he could think of was reaching the wall and finding the three-eyed crow. But now that they were here, he was filled with fears. The dream he'd had, the dream that Summer had had. No, I mustn't think about that dream. He had not even told the Reeds, though Mira at least seemed to sense that something was wrong. If he never talked of it, maybe he could forget he ever dreamed it, and then it wouldn't have happened, and Rob and Grey Wind would still be...
"Hodor!"
Hodor shifted his weight and ran with it. He was tired. They had been walking for hours. "At least he's not afraid." Bran was scared of this place, and almost as scared of admitting it to the Reeds. "I'm a prince of the north, a Stark of Winterfell, almost a man grown. I have to be as brave as Rob." Jojen gazed up at him with his dark green eyes.
"There's nothing here to hurt us, Your Grace."
Bran wasn't so certain. The Night Fort had figured in some of old Nan's scariest stories. It was here that Night's King had reigned, before his name was wiped from the memory of man. This was where the Rat Cook had served the Andal King his prince and bacon pie, where the 79 Sentinels stood their watch, where brave young Danny Flint
had been raped and murdered. This was a castle where King Sherrett had called down his curse on the Andals of old, where the prentice boys had faced the thing that came in the night, where blind Simeon Star Eyes had seen the hellhounds fighting. Mad Axe had once walked these yards and climbed these towers, butchering his brothers in the dark. All that had happened hundreds and thousands of years ago, to be sure, and some maybe never happened at all. Maester Lewin always said that old man's stories shouldn't be swallowed whole. But once his uncle came to see Father, and Bran asked about the night fort. Benjen Stark never said the tales were true, but he never said they weren't. He only shrugged and said, "We left the night fort 200 years ago," as if that was an answer. Bran forced himself to look around. The morning was cold but bright, the sun shining down from a hard blue sky, but he did not like the noises. The wind made a nervous whistling sound as it shivered through the broken towers. The keeps groaned and settled, and he could hear rats scrabbling under the floor of the great hall. The rat cook's children running from their father. The yards were small forests where spindly trees rubbed their bare branches together and dead leaves scuttled like roaches across patches of old snow. There were trees growing where the stables had been, and a twisted white weirwood pushing up through the gaping hole in the roof of the domed kitchen. Even summer was not at ease here. Bran slipped inside his skin, just for an instant, to get the smell of the place. He did not like that either. And there was no way through. Bran had told them there wouldn't be. He had told them and told them. But Jojen Reed had insisted on seeing for himself. He had had a green dream, he said, and his green dreams did not lie. They don't open any gates either, thought Bran. The gate the night fort guarded had been sealed since the day the Black Brothers had loaded up their mules and garrons and departed for Deep Lake. Its iron portcullis lowered, the chains that raised it carried off, the tunnel packed with stone and rubble all frozen together until they were as impenetrable as the wall itself. "We should have followed John," Bran said when he saw it. He thought of his bastard brother often, since the night that summer had watched him ride off through the storm. "We should have found the King's Road and gone to Castle Black." "We dare not, my prince," Jojen said. "I've told you why." "But there are wildlings. They kill some man, and they wanted to kill John too. Jojen, there were 100 of them." "So you said. We are 4. You helped your brother, if that was him in truth, but it almost cost you summer." "I know," Bran said miserably. The direwolf had killed 3 of them, maybe more, but there had been too many. When they formed a tight ring around the tall, earless man, he had tried to slip away through the rain, but one of their arrows had come flashing after him, and the sudden stab of pain had driven Bran out of the wolfskin and back into his own. After the storm finally died, they had huddled in the dark without a fire, talking in whispers, if they talked at all, listening to Hodor's heavy breathing, and wondering if the wildlings might try and cross the lake in the morning. Bran had reached out for summer time and time again, but the pain he found drove him back, the way a red-hot kettle makes you pull your hand back, even when you mean to grab it. Only Hodor slept that night, muttering, "Hodor, Hodor," as he tussed and turned. Bran was terrified that summer was off, dying in the darkness. "Please, you old gods," he prayed. "You took Winterfell and my father and my legs. Please don't take summer, too. And watch over Jon Snow, too, and make these wildlings go away." No weirwoods grew on that stony island in the lake, yet somehow the old gods must have heard. The wildlings took their sweet time about departing the next morning, stripping the bodies of their dead and the old man they'd killed, even pulling a few fish from the lake. And there was a scary moment when 3 of them found the causeway and started to walk out. But the path turned, and they didn't, and two of them nearly drowned before the others pulled them out. The tall, bald man yelled at them, his words echoing across the water in some tongue that even Jojen did not know. And a little while later, they gathered up their shields and spears and marched off north by east, the same way John had gone. Bran wanted to leave, too, to look for summer, but the reed said no.
"We will stay another night," said Jojen. "Put some leagues between us and the wildlings. You don't want to meet them again, do you?"
Late that afternoon, Summer returned from wherever he'd been hiding, dragging his back leg. He ate parts of the bodies in the inn, driving off the crows, then swam out to the island. Mira had drawn the broken arrow from his leg and rubbed the wound with the juice of some plants she'd found growing around the base of the tower. The dire wolf was still limping, but a little less each day, it seemed to Bran. The guards had heard.
"Maybe we should try another castle," Mira said to her brother. "Maybe we could get through the gate somewhere else. I could go scout if you wanted. I'd make better time by myself."
Bran shook his head.
"If you go east, there's Deep Lake, then Queensgate. West is Icemark. But they'll be the same, only smaller. All the gates are sealed, except the ones at Castle Black, Eastwatch, and the Shadow Tower."
Hodor said, "Hodor," to that, and the reeds exchanged a look.
"At least I should climb to the top of the wall," Mira decided. "Maybe I'll see something up there." "What could you hope to see?" Jojen asked. "Something," said Mira, and for once she was adamant.
"It should be me." Bran raised his head to look up at the wall and imagined himself climbing inch by inch, squirming his fingers into cracks in the ice and kicking footholds with his toes. That made him smile, in spite of everything. The dreams and the wildlings and John and everything. He had climbed the walls of Winterfell when he was little, and all the towers too, but none of them had been so high. And they were only stone. The wall could look like stone, all grey and pitted, but then the clouds would break, and the sun would hit it differently, and all at once it would transform and stand there white and blue and glittering. It was the end of the world, old Nan always said. On the other side were monsters and giants and ghouls, but they could not pass so long as the wall stood strong. "I want to stand on top with Mira," Bran thought. "I want to stand on top and see." But he was a broken boy with useless legs, so all he could do was watch from below as Mira went up in his stead. She wasn't really climbing the way he used to climb. She was only walking up some steps that the Night's Watch had hewn hundreds and thousands of years ago. He remembered Maester Luwin saying the Night Fort was the only castle where the steps had been cut from the ice of the wall itself. Or maybe it had been Uncle Benjen. The newer castles had wooden steps, or stone ones, or long ramps of earth and gravel. "Ice is too treacherous." It was his uncle who told him that. He said that the outer surface of the wall wept icy tears sometimes, though the core inside stayed frozen, hard as rock. The steps must have melted and refrozen 1,000 times since the last Black Brothers left the castle, and every time they did, they shrunk a little and got smoother and rounder and more treacherous. And smaller. It's almost like the wall was swallowing them back into itself. Mira Reed was very sure-footed, but even so she was going slowly, moving from nub to nub. In two places where the steps were hardly there at all, she got down on all fours. "It will be worse when she comes down," Bran thought, watching. Even so he wished it was him up there. When she reached the top, crawling up the icy knobs that were all that remained of the higher steps, Mira vanished from his sight.
"When will she come down?" Bran asked Jojen. "When she is ready. She will want to have a good look at the wall and what's beyond. We should do the same down here."
"Hodor?"
said Hodor, doubtfully.
"We might find something," Jojen insisted.
"Or something might find us." Bran couldn't say it, though. He did not want Jojen to think he was crazy.